Judy Obscure. Part First, I. At Mary Green. Yea, many there be that have run out of their wits for women, and become servants for their sakes. Many also have perished, have erred, and sinned, for women. O ye men, how can it be but women should be strong, seeing they do thus? Esdras. The schoolmaster was leaving the village, and everybody seemed sorry. The miller at Crescombe lent him the small white tilted cart and horse to carry his goods to the city of his destination, about 20 miles off, such a vehicle proving of quite sufficient size for the departing teacher's effects. For the schoolhouse had been partly furnished by the managers, and the only cumbersome article possessed by the master, in addition to the packing case of books, was a cottage piano that he had bought at an auction during the year in which he thought of learning instrumental music. But the enthusiasm having waned, he had never acquired any skill in playing, and the purchased article had been a perpetual trouble to him ever since in moving house. The rector had gone away for the day, being a man who disliked the sight of changes. He did not mean to return till the evening, when the new schoolteacher would have arrived and settled in, and everything would be smooth again. The blacksmith, the farm bailiff, and the schoolmaster himself were standing in perplexed attitudes in the parlor before the instrument. The master had remarked that even if he got it into the cart, he should not know what to do with it on his arrival at Christminster, the city he was bound for, since he was only going into temporary lodgings just at first. A little boy of 11, who had been thoughtfully assisting in the packing, joined the group of men, and as they rubbed their chins he spoke up, blushing at the sound of his own voice, "And have got a great fuel house, and it could be put there, perhaps, till you found a place to settle in, sir." "A proper good notion," said the blacksmith. It was decided that a deputation should wait on the boy's aunt, an old maiden resident, and ask her if she would house the piano till Mr. Phillotson should send for it. The smith and the bailiff started to see about the practicability of the suggested shelter, and the boy and the schoolmaster were left standing alone. "Sorry I am going, Jude?" asked the latter kindly. Tears rose into the boy's eyes, for he was not among the regular day scholars, who came unromantically close to the schoolmaster's life, but one who had attended the night school only during the present teacher's term of office. The regular scholars, if the truth must be told, stood at the present moment afar off, like certain historic disciples, indisposed to any enthusiastic volunteering of aid. The boy awkwardly opened the book he held in his hand, which Mr. Phillotson had bestowed on him as a parting gift, and admitted that he was sorry. "So am I," said Mr. Phillotson.
"Why do you go, sir?" asked the boy.
"Ah, that would be a long story. You wouldn't understand my reasons, Jude. You will, perhaps, when you are older."
"I think I should now, sir."
"Well, don't speak of this everywhere. You know what a university is, and a university degree? It is the necessary hallmark of a man who wants to do anything in teaching. My scheme, or dream, is to be a university graduate, and then to be ordained. By going to live at Christminster, or near it, I shall be at headquarters, so to speak, and if my scheme is practicable at all, I consider that being on the spot will afford me a better chance of carrying it out than I should have elsewhere." The smith and his companion returned. Old Miss Folly's fuel house was dry, and eminently practicable, and she seemed willing to give the instrument standing room there. It was accordingly left in the school till the evening, when more hands would be available for removing it, and the schoolmaster gave a final glance round. The boy Jude assisted in loading some small articles, and at 9 o'clock Mr. Phillotson mounted beside his box of books and other impedimenta, and bade his friends goodbye. "I shan't forget you, Jude," he said, smiling, as the cart moved off. "Be a good boy, remember, and be kind to animals and birds, and read all you can. And if ever you come to Christminster, remember you hunt me out for old acquaintance' sake." The cart creaked across the green, and disappeared round the corner by the rectory house. The boy returned to the draw well at the edge of the greensward, where he had left his buckets when he went to help his patron and teacher in the loading. There was a quiver in his lip now, and after opening the well cover to begin lowering the bucket, he paused and leant with his forehead and arms against the framework, his face wearing the fixity of a thoughtful child's who has felt the pricks of life somewhat before his time. The well into which he was looking was as ancient as the village itself, and from his present position appeared as a long circular perspective ending in a shining disc of quivering water at a distance of 100 feet down. There was a lining of green moss near the top, and nearer still the hart's tongue fern. He said to himself, in the melodramatic tones of a whimsical boy, that the schoolmaster had drawn at that well scores of times on a morning like this, and would never draw there any more. "I've seen him look down into it, when he was tired with his drawing, just as I do now, and when he rested a bit before carrying the buckets home.
But he was too clever to bide here any longer, a small sleepy place like this. A tear rolled from his eye into the depths of the well. The morning was a little foggy, and the boy's breathing unfurled itself as a thicker fog upon the still and heavy air. His thoughts were interrupted by a sudden outcry. "Bring on that water, will ye, you idle young harlequin?" It came from an old woman who had emerged from her door towards the garden gate of a green-thatched cottage not far off. The boy quickly waved a signal of assent, drew the water with what was a great effort for one of his stature, landed and emptied the big bucket into his own pair of smaller ones, and pausing a moment for breath, started with them across the patch of clammy green sward whereon the well stood nearly in the center of the little village, or rather hamlet of Marygreen. It was as old-fashioned as it was small, and it rested in the lap of an undulating upland adjoining the North Wessex Downs. Old as it was, however, the well shaft was probably the only relic of the local history that remained absolutely unchanged. Many of the thatched and dormered dwelling houses had been pulled down of late years, and many trees felled on the green. Above all, the original church, humpbacked, wood-turreted, and quaintly hipped, had been taken down, and either cracked up into heaps of road metal in the lane, or utilized as pigsty walls, garden seats, guard stones to fences, and rockeries in the flower beds of the neighborhood. In place of it, a tall new building of modern Gothic design, unfamiliar to English eyes, had been erected on a new piece of ground by a certain obliterator of historic records who had run down from London and back in a day. The site whereon so long had stood the ancient temple to the Christian divinities was not even recorded on the green and level grass plot that had immemorially been the churchyard, the obliterated graves being commemorated by 18 penny cast iron crosses warranted to last 5 years, too. Slender as was Jude Foley's frame, he bore the two brimming house buckets of water to the cottage without resting. Over the door was a little rectangular piece of blue board, on which was painted in yellow letters, "Drusilla Foley, Baker." Within the little lead panes of the window, this being one of the few old houses left, were 5 bottles of sweets, and 3 buns on a plate of the willow pattern. While emptying the buckets at the back of the house, he could hear an animated conversation in progress within doors between his great aunt, the Drusilla of the signboard, and some other villagers. Having seen the schoolmaster depart, they were summing up particulars of the event, and indulging in predictions of his future. "And who's he?" asked one, comparatively a stranger, when the boy entered. "Well, ye met ask it, Mrs. Williams. He's my great-nephew come since you was last this way." The old inhabitant who answered was a tall, gaunt woman, who spoke tragically on the most trivial subject, and gave a phrase of her conversation to each auditor in turn. "He come from Mellstock, down in South Wessex, about a year ago, worse luck for un, Belinda," turning to the right, "where his father was living, and was took by the shakings for death, and died in 2 days, as you know, Caroline," turning to the left. "It would ha' been a blessing if God Almighty had took thee too, why thy mother and father, poor useless boy. But I've got him here to stay with me till I can see what's to be done with un, though I am obliged to let him earn any penny he can. Just now he's a scaring of birds for Farmer Trutham. It keeps him out of mischief. Why do ye turn away, Jude?" she continued, as the boy, feeling the impact of their glances like slaps upon his face, moved aside. The local washerwoman replied that it was perhaps a very good plan of Miss or Mrs. Foley's, as they called her indifferently, to have him with her to keep ye company in your loneliness, fetch water, shut the winder shutters o' nights, and help in the bit o' baking. Miss Foley doubted it. "Why didn't ye get the schoolmaster to take ye to Christminster Wyon, and make a scholar of ye?" she continued, in frowning pleasantry. "I'm sure he couldn't ha' took a better one. The boy is crazy for books, that he is. It runs in our family rather. His cousin Sue is just the same, so I've heard, but I have not seen the child for years, though she was born in this place, within these 4 walls, as it happened. My niece and her husband, after they were married, didn't get a house of their own for some year or more, and then they only had one till, well, I won't go into that. Jude, my child, don't you ever marry. 'Tisn't for the Follies to take that step any more. She, their only one, was like a child of my own, Belinda, till the split come. Ah, that a little maid should know such changes." Jude, finding the general attention again centering on himself, went out to the bakehouse, where he ate the cake provided for his breakfast. The end of his spare time had now arrived, and emerging from the garden by getting over the hedge at the back, he pursued a path northward, till he came to a wide and lonely depression in the general level of the upland, which was sown as a cornfield. This vast concave was the scene of his labors for Mr. Trutham the farmer, and he descended into the midst of it. The brown surface of the field went right up towards the sky all round, where it was lost by degrees in the mist that shut out the actual verge and accentuated the solitude. The only marks on the uniformity of the scene were a rick of last year's produce standing in the midst of the arable, the rooks that rose at his approach, and the path athwart the fallow by which he had come, trodden now by he hardly knew whom, though once by many of his own dead family. "How ugly it is here," he murmured. The fresh harrow lines seemed to stretch like the channelings in a piece of new corduroy, lending a meanly utilitarian air to the expanse, taking away its gradations, and depriving it of all history beyond that of the few recent months, though to every clod and stone there really attached associations enough and to spare echoes of songs from ancient harvest days, of spoken words, and of sturdy deeds. Every inch of ground had been the site, first or last, of energy, gaiety, horseplay, bickerings, weariness. Groups of gleaners had squatted in the sun on every yard too. Love matches that had populated the adjoining hamlet had been made up there between reaping and carrying. Under the hedge which divided the field from a distant plantation, girls had given themselves to lovers who would not turn their heads to look at them by the next harvest, and in that ancient cornfield many a man had made love promises to a woman at whose voice he had trembled by the next seed time after fulfilling them in the church adjoining. But this neither Jude nor the rooks around him considered. For them it was a lonely place, possessing, in the one view, only the quality of a work ground, and in the other that of a granary good to feed in. The boy stood under the rick before mentioned, and every few seconds used his clacker or rattle briskly. At each clack the rooks left off becking, and rose and went away on their leisurely wings, burnished like tassets of mail, afterwards wheeling back and regarding him wearily, and descending to feed at a more respectful distance. He sounded the clacker till his arm ached, and at length his heart grew sympathetic with the bird's thwarted desires. They seemed, like himself, to be living in a world which did not want them. Why should he frighten them away? They took upon more and more the aspect of gentle friends and pensioners, the only friends he could claim as being in the least degree interested in him, for his aunt had often told him that she was not. He ceased his rattling, and they alighted anew. "Poor little dears," said Jude, aloud. "You shall have some dinner, you shall. There is enough for us all. Farmer Trutham can afford to let you have some. Eat, then, my dear little birdies, and make a good meal." They stayed and ate, inky spots on the nut-brown soil, and Jude enjoyed their appetite. A magic thread of fellow feeling united his own life with theirs. Puny and sorry as those lives were, they much resembled his own. His clacker he had by this time thrown away from him, as being a mean and sordid instrument, offensive both to the birds and to himself as their friend. All at once he became conscious of a smart blow upon his buttocks, followed by a loud clack, which announced to his surprised senses that the clacker had been the instrument of offense used. The birds and Jude started up simultaneously, and the dazed eyes of the latter beheld the farmer in person, the great Trutham himself, his red face glaring down upon Jude's cowering frame, the clacker swinging in his hand. "So it's eat, my dear birdies, is it, young man? Eat, dear birdies, indeed. I'll tickle your breeches, and see if you say, 'Eat, dear birdies,' again in a hurry. And you've been idling at the schoolmaster's too, instead of coming here, haunt ye, hey? That's how you earn your sixpence a day for keeping the rooks off my corn." Whilst saluting Jude's ears with this impassioned rhetoric, Trutham had seized his left hand with his own left, and swinging his slim frame round him at arm's length, again struck Jude on the hind parts with the flat side of Jude's own rattle, till the field echoed with the blows, which were delivered once or twice at each revolution. "Don't he, sir, please don't he," cried the whirling child, as helpless under the centrifugal tendency of his person as a hooked fish swinging to land, and beholding the hill, the rick, the plantation, the path, and the rooks going round and round him in an amazing circular race. "Aye, sir, only meant that there was a good crop in the ground. I saw him sow it, and the rooks could have a little bit for dinner and you wouldn't miss it, sir, and Mr. Phillotson said I was to be kind to him, oh. This truthful explanation seemed to exasperate the farmer even more than if Jude had stoutly denied saying anything at all, and he still smacked the whirling urchin, the clacks of the instrument continuing to resound all across the field and as far as the ears of distant workers who gathered thereupon that Jude was pursuing his business of clacking with great assiduity and echoing from the brand new church tower just behind the mist, towards the building of which structure the farmer had largely subscribed, to testify his love for God and man. Presently Trutham grew tired of his punitive task, and depositing the quivering boy on his legs, took a sixpence from his pocket and gave it him in payment for his day's work, telling him to go home and never let him see him in one of those fields again. Jude leapt out of arm's reach, and walked along the trackway weeping not from the pain, though that was keen enough, not from the perception of the flaw in the terrestrial scheme, by which what was good for God's birds was bad for God's gardener, but with the awful sense that he had wholly disgraced himself before he had been a year in the parish, and hence might be a burden to his great aunt for life. With this shadow on his mind, he did not care to show himself in the village, and went homeward by a roundabout track behind a high hedge and across a pasture. Here he beheld scores of coupled earthworms lying half their length on the surface of the damp ground, as they always did in such weather at that time of the year. It was impossible to advance in regular steps without crushing some of them at each tread. Though Farmer Trootham had just hurt him, he was a boy who could not himself bear to hurt anything. He had never brought home a nest of young birds without lying awake in misery half the night after, and often reinstating them in the nest in their original place the next morning. He could scarcely bear to see trees cut down or lopped, from a fancy that it hurt them, and late pruning, when the sap was up and a tree bled profusely, had been a positive grief to him in his infancy. This weakness of character, as it may be called, suggested that he was the sort of man who was born to ache a good deal before the fall of the curtain upon his unnecessary life should signify that all was well with him again. He carefully picked his way on tiptoe among the earthworms, without killing a single one. On entering the cottage he found his aunt selling a penny loaf to a little girl, and when the customer was gone she said, "Well, how do you come to be back here in the middle of the morning like this?"
"I'm turned away."
"What?" "Mr. Trootham have turned me away because I let the rooks have a few peckings of corn. And there's my wages the last I shall ever hay." He threw the sixpence tragically on the table.
"Ah," said his aunt, suspending her breath. And she opened upon him a lecture on how she would now have him all the spring upon her hands doing nothing. "If you can't scare birds, what can ye do? There. Don't ye look so deedy. Farmer Trootham is not so much better than myself, come to that. But 'tis as Job said, now they that are younger than I have me in derision, whose fathers I would have disdained to have set with the dogs of my flock." His father was my father's journeyman, anyhow, and I must have been a fool to let he go to work for an, which I shouldn't ha done but to keep he out of mischief. More angry with Jude for demeaning her by coming there than for dereliction of duty, she rated him primarily from that point of view, and only secondarily from a moral one. "Not that you should have let the birds eat what Farmer Trootham planted. Of course you was wrong in that. Jude, Jude, why didst'nt go off with that schoolmaster of thine to Christminster or somewhere? But, oh no, poor ornery child, there never was any sprawl on thy side of the family, and never will be. Where's this beautiful city, and this place where Mr. Phillotson is gone to?" asked the boy, after meditating in silence.
"Lord! You ought to know where the city of Christminster is. Near a score of miles from here. It is a place much too good for you ever to have much to do with, poor boy, I'm a-thinking."
"And will Mr. Phillotson always be there?"
"How can I tell?
Could I go to see him?"
"Lord, no. You didn't grow up hereabout, or you wouldn't ask such as that. We've never had anything to do with folk in Christminster, nor folk in Christminster with we."
Jude went out, and, feeling more than ever his existence to be an undemanded one, he lay down upon his back on a heap of litter near the pigsty. The fog had by this time become more translucent, and the position of the sun could be seen through it. He pulled his straw hat over his face, and peered through the interstices of the plating at the white brightness, vaguely reflecting. Growing up brought responsibilities, he found. Events did not rhyme quite as he had thought. Nature's logic was too horrid for him to care for. That mercy towards one set of creatures was cruelty towards another sickened his sense of harmony. As you got older, and felt yourself to be at the center of your time, and not at a point in its circumference, as you had felt when you were little, you were seized with a sort of shuddering, he perceived. All around you there seemed to be something glaring, garish, rattling, and the noises and glares hit upon the little cell called your life, and shook it, and warped it. If he could only prevent himself growing up. He did not want to be a man. Then, like the natural boy, he forgot his despondency, and sprang up. During the remainder of the morning he helped his aunt, and in the afternoon, when there was nothing more to be done, he went into the village. Here he asked a man whereabouts Christminster lay.
"Christminster? Oh, well, out by there yonder, though I've never been there, not I. I've never had any business at such a place."
The man pointed northeastward, in the very direction where lay the field in which Jude had so disgraced himself. There was something unpleasant about the coincidence for the moment, but the fearsomeness of this fact rather increased his curiosity about the city. The farmer had said he was never to be seen in that field again, yet Christminster lay across it, and the path was a public one. So, stealing out of the hamlet, he descended into the same hollow which had witnessed his punishment in the morning, never swerving an inch from the path,
and climbing up the long and tedious ascent on the other side till the track joined the highway by a little clump of trees. Here the ploughed land ended, and all before him was bleak open down.
3.
Not a soul was visible on the hedgeless highway, or on either side of it, and the white road seemed to ascend and diminish till it joined the sky. At the very top it was crossed at right angles by a green ridgeway, the Icknield Street, an original Roman road through the district. This ancient track ran east and west for many miles, and down almost to within living memory had been used for driving flocks and herds to fairs and markets. But it was now neglected and overgrown. The boy had never before strayed so far north as this from the nestling hamlet in which he had been deposited by the carrier from a railway station southward, one dark evening some few months earlier, and till now he had had no suspicion that such a wide, flat, low-lying country lay so near at hand, under the very verge of his upland world. The whole northern semicircle between east and west, to a distance of 40 or 50 miles, spread itself before him, a bluer, moister atmosphere, evidently, than that he breathed up here. Not far from the road stood a weather-beaten old barn of reddish-gray brick and tile. It was known as the Brown House by the people of the locality. He was about to pass it when he perceived a ladder against the eaves, and the reflection that the higher he got, the further he could see, led Jude to stand and regard it. On the slope of the roof two men were repairing the tiling. He turned into the ridgeway and drew towards the barn. When he had wistfully watched the workmen for some time he took courage, and ascended the ladder till he stood beside them. "Well, my lad, and what may you want up here?" "I wanted to know where the city of Christminster is, if you please."
"Christminster is out across there, by that clump. You can see it, at least you can on a clear day."
"Ah, no, you can't now."
The other tiler, glad of any kind of diversion from the monotony of his labor, had also turned to look towards the quarter designated. "You can't often see it in weather like this," he said. "The time I've noticed it is when the sun is going down in a blaze of flame, and it looks like I don't know what."
"The heavenly Jerusalem," suggested the serious urchin. "Although I should never ha' thought of it myself. But I can't see no Christminster today."
The boy strained his eyes also, yet neither could he see the far-off city. He descended from the barn, and abandoning Christminster with the versatility of his age he walked along the ridge track, looking for any natural objects of interest that might lie in the banks thereabout. When he repassed the barn to go back to Mary Green he observed that the ladder was still in its place, but that the men had finished their day's work and gone away. It was waning towards evening, there was still a faint mist, but it had cleared a little except in the damper tracts of subjacent country and along the river courses. He thought again of Christminster, and wished, since he had come 2 or 3 miles from his aunt's house on purpose, that he could have seen for once this attractive city of which he had been told. But even if he waited here it was hardly likely that the air would clear before night. Yet he was loath to leave the spot, for the northern expanse became lost to view on retreating towards the village only a few hundred yards. He ascended the ladder to have one more look at the point the man had designated, and perched himself on the highest rung, overlying the tiles. He might not be able to come so far as this for many days. Perhaps if he prayed, the wish to see Christminster might be forwarded. People said that, if you prayed, things sometimes came to you, even though they sometimes did not. He had read in a tract that a man who had begun to build a church, and had no money to finish it, knelt down and prayed, and the money came in by the next post. Another man tried the same experiment, and the money did not come, but he found afterwards that the breaches he knelt in were made by a wicked Jew. This was not discouraging, and turning on the ladder Jude knelt on the third rung, where, resting against those above it, he prayed that the mist might rise. He then seated himself again, and waited. In the course of 10 or 15 minutes the thinning mist dissolved altogether from the northern horizon, as it had already done elsewhere, and about a quarter of an hour before the time of sunset the westward clouds parted, the sun's position being partially uncovered, and the beams streaming out in visible lines between two bars of slaty cloud. The boy immediately looked back in the old direction. Some way within the limits of the stretch of landscape, points of light like the topaz gleamed. The air increased in transparency with the lapse of minutes, till the topaz points showed themselves to be the vanes, windows, wet roof slates, and other shining spots upon the spires, domes, freestone work, and varied outlines that were faintly revealed. It was Christminster, unquestionably, either directly seen, or miraged in the peculiar atmosphere. The spectator gazed on it until the windows and vanes lost their shine, going out almost suddenly like extinguished candles. The vague city became veiled in mist. Turning to the west, he saw that the sun had disappeared. The foreground of the scene had grown funereally dark, and near objects put on the hues and shapes of chimeras. He anxiously descended the ladder, and started homewards at a run, trying not to think of giants, Herne the hunter, Apollyon lying in wait for Christian, or of the captain with the bleeding hole in his forehead and the corpses round him that were mutinied every night on board the bewitched ship. He knew that he had grown out of belief in these horrors, yet he was glad when he saw the church tower and the lights in the cottage windows, even though this was not the home of his birth, and his great aunt did not care much about him. Inside and round about that old woman's shop window, with its 24 little panes set in lead work, the glass of some of them oxidized with age, so that you could hardly see the poor penny articles exhibited within, and forming part of a stock which a strong man could have carried, Jude had his outer being for some long tideless time. But his dreams were as gigantic as his surroundings were small. Through the solid barrier of cold Cretaceous upland to the northward he was always beholding a gorgeous city, the fancied place he had likened to the New Jerusalem, though there was perhaps more of the painter's imagination and less of the diamond merchant's in his dreams thereof than in those of the apocalyptic writer. And the city acquired a tangibility, a permanence, a hold on his life, mainly from the one nucleus of fact that the man for whose knowledge and purposes he had so much reverence was actually living there, not only so, but living among the more thoughtful and metally shining ones therein. In sad wet seasons, though he knew it must rain at Christminster too, he could hardly believe that it rained so drearily there. Whenever he could get away from the confines of the hamlet for an hour or two, which was not often, he would steal off to the brown house on the hill and strain his eyes persistently, sometimes to be rewarded by the sight of a dome or spire, at other times by a little smoke, which in his estimate had some of the mysticism of incense. Then the day came when it suddenly occurred to him that if he ascended to the point of view after dark, or possibly went a mile or two further, he would see the night lights of the city. It would be necessary to come back alone, but even that consideration did not deter him, for he could throw a little manliness into his mood, no doubt. The project was duly executed. It was not late when he arrived at the place of outlook, only just after dusk, but a black northeast sky, accompanied by a wind from the same quarter, made the occasion dark enough. He was rewarded, but what he saw was not the lamps in rows, as he had half expected. No individual light was visible, only a halo or glow fog overarching the place against the black heavens behind it, making the light and the city seem distant but a mile or so. He set himself to wonder on the exact point in the glow where the schoolmaster might be, he who never communicated with anybody at Marygreen now, who was as if dead to them here. In the glow he seemed to see Phillotson promenading at ease, like one of the forms in Nebuchadnezzar's furnace. He had heard that breezes traveled at the rate of 10 miles an hour, and the fact now came into his mind. He parted his lips as he faced the northeast, and drew in the wind as if it were a sweet liquor. "You," he said, addressing the breeze caressingly, "were in Christminster City between 1 and 2 hours ago, floating along the streets, pulling round the weathercocks, touching Mr. Phillotson's face, being breathed by him, and now you are here, breathed by me, you, the very same." Suddenly there came along this wind something towards him, a message from the place, from some soul residing there, it seemed. Surely it was the sound of bells, the voice of the city, faint and musical, calling to him, "We are happy here." He had become entirely lost to his bodily situation during this mental leap, and only got back to it by a rough recalling. A few yards below the brow of the hill on which he paused a team of horses made its appearance, having reached the place by dint of half an hour's serpentine progress from the bottom of the immense declivity. They had a load of coals behind them, a fuel that could only be got into the upland by this particular route. They were accompanied by a carter, a second man, and a boy, who now kicked a large stone behind one of the wheels, and allowed the panting animals to have a long rest, while those in charge took a flagon off the load and indulged in a drink round. They were elderly men, and had genial voices. Jude addressed them, inquiring if they had come from Christminster. "Heaven forbid, with this load," said they. "The place I mean is that one yonder." He was getting so romantically attached to Christminster that, like a young lover alluding to his mistress, he felt bashful at mentioning its name again. He pointed to the light in the sky, hardly perceptible to their older eyes. "Yes. There do seem a spot a bit brighter in the northeast than elsewhere, though I shouldn't ha noticed it myself, and no doubt it med be Christminster." Here a little book of tales which Jude had tucked up under his arm, having brought them to read on his way hither before it grew dark, slipped and fell into the road. The carter eyed him while he picked it up and straightened the leaves. "Ah, young man," he observed, "you'd have to get your head screwed on t'other way before you could read what they read there." "Why?" asked the boy. "Oh, they never look at anything that folks like we can understand," the carter continued, by way of passing the time. "Only foreign tongues used in the days of the Tower of Babel, when no two families spoke alike. They read that sort of thing as fast as a nighthawk will were. 'Tis all learning there, nothing but learning, except religion. And that's learning too, for I never could understand it. Yes, 'tis a serious-minded place. Not but there's wenches in the streets o' nights. You know, I suppose, that they raise paisans there like radishes in a bed? And though it do take how many years, Bob?
5 years to turn a lirruping hobbledehoy chap into a solemn preaching man with no corrupt passions, they'll do it, if it can be done, and polish on off like the workmen they be, and turn on out wire long face, and a long black coat and waistcoat, and a religious collar and hat, same as they used to wear in the scriptures, so that his own mother wouldn't know on sometimes. There, 'tis their business, like anybody else's.
But how should you know?
Now don't you interrupt, my boy. Never interrupt your seniors. Move the four hoss aside, Bobby, here's so Matt coming. You must mind that I be a talking of the college life. Lives on a lofty level, there's no gainsaying it, though I myself med not think much of 'em. As we be here in our bodies on this high ground, so be they in their minds noble-minded men enough, no doubt some on 'em able to earn hundreds by thinking out loud. And some on 'em be strong young fellows that can earn a'most as much in silver cups. As for music, there's beautiful music everywhere in Christminster. You med be religious, or you med not, but you can't help striking in your homely note with the rest. And there's a street in the place, the main street, that haunty and other like it in the world. I should think I did know a little about Christminster. By this time the horses had recovered breath and bent to their collars again. Jude, throwing a last adoring look at the distant halo, turned and walked beside his remarkably well-informed friend, who had no objection to telling him as they moved on more yet of the city, its towers and halls and churches. The wagon turned into a crossroad, whereupon Jude thanked the carter warmly for his information, and said he only wished he could talk half as well about Christminster as he.
"Well, 'tis only what has come in my way," said the carter unboastfully. "I've never been there, no more than you, but I've picked up the knowledge here and there, and you'd be welcome to it. Hey, getting about the world as I do, and mixing with all classes of society, one can't help hearing of things. A friend of mine, that used to claim the boots at the Crozier Hotel in Christminster when he was in his prime, why, I know done as well as my own brother in his later years."
Jude continued his walk homeward alone, pondering so deeply that he forgot to feel timid. He suddenly grew older. It had been the yearning of his heart to find something to anchor on, to cling to for some place which he could call admirable. Should he find that place in this city if he could get there? Would it be a spot in which, without fear of farmers, or hindrance, or ridicule, he could watch and wait, and set himself to some mighty undertaking like the men of old of whom he had heard? As the halo had been to his eyes when gazing at it a quarter of an hour earlier, so was the spot mentally to him as he pursued his dark way. "It is a city of light," he said to himself. "The tree of knowledge grows there," he added a few steps further on. "It is a place that teachers of men spring from and go to. It is what you may call a castle, manned by scholarship and religion." After this figure he was silent a long while, till he added, "It would just suit me, for..." Walking somewhat slowly by reason of his concentration, the boy, an ancient man in some phases of thought, much younger than his years and others, was overtaken by a light-footed pedestrian, whom, notwithstanding the gloom, he could perceive to be wearing an extraordinarily tall hat, a swallow-tailed coat, and a watch-chain that danced madly and threw round scintillations of skylight as its owner swung along upon a pair of thin legs and noiseless boots. Jude, beginning to feel lonely, endeavored to keep up with him.
"Well, my man, I'm in a hurry, so you'll have to walk pretty fast if you keep alongside of me. Do you know who I am?"
"Yes, I think. Physician Vilbert?"
"Ah, I'm known everywhere, I see. That comes of being a public benefactor."
Vilbert was an itinerant quack doctor, well known to the rustic population, and absolutely unknown to anybody else, as he, indeed, took care to be, to avoid inconvenient investigations. Cottagers formed his only patients, and his Wessex-wide repute was among them alone. His position was humbler and his field more obscure than those of the quacks with capital and an organized system of advertising. He was, in fact, a survival. The distances he traversed on foot were enormous, and extended nearly the whole length and breadth of Wessex. Jude had one day seen him selling a pot of colored lard to an old woman as a certain cure for a bad leg, the woman arranging to pay a guinea, in installments of a shilling a fortnight, for the precious salve, which, according to the physician, could only be obtained from a particular animal which grazed on Mount Sinai, and was to be captured only at great risk to life and limb. Jude, though he already had his doubts about this gentleman's medicines, felt him to be unquestionably a traveled personage,
and one who might be a trustworthy source of information on matters not strictly professional. I suppose you've been to Christminster, physician?
I have many times, replied the long thin man. That's one of my centers.
It's a wonderful city for scholarship and religion?
You'd say so, my boy, if you'd seen it. Why, the very sons of the old women who do the washing of the colleges can talk in Latin, not good Latin, that I admit, as a critic, dog Latin, cat Latin, as we used to call it in my undergraduate days.
And Greek?
Well, that's more for the men who are in training for bishops, that they may be able to read the New Testament in the original.
I want to learn Latin and Greek myself.
A lofty desire. You must get a grammar of each tongue.
I mean to go to Christminster someday.
Whenever you do, you say that physician Vilbert is the only proprietor of those celebrated pills that infallibly cure all disorders of the alimentary system, as well as asthma and shortness of breath. 2 and 3 pence a box, specially licensed by the government stamp.
Can you get me the grammars if I promise to say it hereabout?
I'll sell you mine with pleasure, those I used as a student.
Oh, thank you, sir, said Jude gratefully, but in gasps, for the amazing speed of the physician's walk kept him in a dog trot which was giving him a stitch in the side.
I think you'd better drop behind, my young man. Now I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll get you the grammars, and give you a first lesson, if you'll remember, at every house in the village, to recommend physician Vilbert's golden ointment, life drops, and female pills.
Where will you be with the grammars?
I shall be passing here this day fortnight at precisely this hour of 7:20. My movements are as truly timed as those of the planets in their courses.
Here I'll be to meet you, said Jude.
With orders for my medicines?
Yes, physician.
Jude then dropped behind, waited a few minutes to recover breath, and went home with a consciousness of having struck a blow for Christminster. Through the intervening fortnight he ran about and smiled outwardly at his inward thoughts, as if they were people meeting and nodding to him, smiled with that singularly beautiful irradiation which is seen to spread on young faces at the inception of some glorious idea, as if a supernatural lamp were held inside their transparent natures, giving rise to the flattering fancy that heaven lies about them then. He honestly performed his promise to the man of many cures, in whom he now sincerely believed, walking miles hither and thither among the surrounding hamlets as the physician's agent in advance. On the evening appointed he stood motionless on the plateau, at the place where he had parted from Vilbert, and there awaited his approach. The road physician was fairly up to time, but, to the surprise of Jude on striking into his pace, which the pedestrian did not diminish by a single unit of force, the latter seemed hardly to recognize his young companion, though with the lapse of the fortnight the evenings had grown light. Jude thought it might perhaps be owing to his wearing another hat, and he saluted the physician with dignity.
Well, my boy? Said the latter abstractedly.
I've come, said Jude.
You?
Who are you?
Oh yes, to be sure. Got any orders, lad?
Yes. And Jude told him the names and addresses of the cottagers who were willing to test the virtues of the world-renowned pills and salve. The quack mentally registered these with great care.
And the Latin and Greek grammars?
Jude's voice trembled with anxiety.
What about them?
You were to bring me yours, that you used before you took your degree.
Ah, yes, yes. Forgot all about it all. So many lives depending on my attention, you see, my man, that I can't give so much thought as I would like to other things.
Jude controlled himself sufficiently long to make sure of the truth, and he repeated, in a voice of dry misery, you haven't brought him.
No. But you must get me some more orders from sick people, and I'll bring the grammars next time.
Jude dropped behind. He was an unsophisticated boy, but the gift of sudden insight which is sometimes vouchsafed to children showed him all at once what shoddy humanity the quack was made of. There was to be no intellectual light from this source. The leaves dropped from his imaginary crown of laurel, he turned to a gate, leant against it, and cried bitterly. The disappointment was followed by an interval of blankness. He might, perhaps, have obtained grammars from Alfredston, but to do that required money, and a knowledge of what books to order, and though physically comfortable, he was in such absolute dependence as to be without a farthing of his own. At this date Mr. Phillotson sent for his pianoforte, and it gave Jude a lead. Why should he not write to the schoolmaster, and ask him to be so kind as to get him the grammars in Christminster? He might slip a letter inside the case of the instrument, and it would be sure to reach the desired eyes. Why not ask him to send any old second-hand copies, which would have the charm of being mellowed by the university atmosphere? To tell his aunt of his intention would be to defeat it. It was necessary to act alone. After a further consideration of a few days he did act,
and on the day of the piano's departure, which happened to be his next birthday, clandestinely placed the letter inside the packing case, directed to his much-admired friend, being afraid to reveal the operation to his Aunt Drusilla, lest she should discover his motive, and compel him to abandon his scheme. The piano was dispatched, and Jude waited days and weeks, calling every morning at the cottage post office before his great-aunt was stirring. At last a packet did indeed arrive at the village, and he saw from the ends of it that it contained two thin books. He took it away into a lonely place, and sat down on a felled elm to open it. Ever since his first ecstasy or vision of Christminster and its possibilities, Jude had meditated much and curiously on the probable sort of process that was involved in turning the expressions of one language into those of another. He concluded that a grammar of the required tongue would contain, primarily, a rule, prescription, or clue of the nature of a secret cipher, which, once known, would enable him, by merely applying it, to change at will all words of his own speech into those of the foreign one. His childish idea was, in fact, a pushing to the extremity of mathematical precision what is everywhere known as Grimm's Law and aggrandizement of rough rules to ideal completeness. Thus he assumed that the words of the required language were always to be found somewhere latent in the words of the given language by those who had the art to uncover them, such art being furnished by the books aforesaid. When, therefore, having noted that the packet bore the postmark of Christminster, he cut the string, opened the volumes, and turned to the Latin grammar, which chanced to come uppermost, he could scarcely believe his eyes. The book was an old one 30 years old, soiled, scribbled wantonly over with a strange name in every variety of enmity to the letterpress, and marked at random with dates 20 years earlier than his own day. But this was not the cause of Jude's amazement. He learnt for the first time that there was no law of transmutation, as in his innocence he had supposed, there was, in some degree, but the grammarian did not recognize it, but that every word in both Latin and Greek was to be individually committed to memory at the cost of years of plodding. Jude flung down the books, lay backward along the broad trunk of the elm, and was an utterly miserable boy for the space of a quarter of an hour. As he had often done before, he pulled his hat over his face and watched the sun peering insidiously at him through the interstices of the straw. This was Latin and Greek, then, was it this grand delusion? The charm he had supposed in store for him was really a labor like that of Israel in Egypt. What brains they must have in Christminster and the great schools, he presently thought, to learn words one by one up to tens of thousands. There were no brains in his head equal to this business, and as the little sunrays continued to stream in through his hat at him, he wished he had never seen a book, that he might never see another, that he had never been born. Somebody might have come along that way who would have asked him his trouble, and might have cheered him by saying that his notions were further advanced than those of his grammarian. But nobody did come, because nobody does, and under the crushing recognition of his gigantic error Jude continued to wish himself out of the world. During the 3 or 4 succeeding years a quaint and singular vehicle might have been discerned moving along the lanes and byroads near Marygreen, driven in a quaint and singular way. In the course of a month or two after the receipt of the books Jude had grown callous to the shabby trick played him by the dead languages. In fact, his disappointment at the nature of those tongues had, after a while, been the means of still further glorifying the erudition of Christminster. To acquire languages, departed or living in spite of such obstinacies as he now knew them inherently to possess, was a Herculean performance which gradually led him on to a greater interest in it than in the presupposed patent process. The mountain weight of material under which the ideas lay in those dusty volumes called the classics piqued him into a dogged, mouse-like subtlety of attempt to move it piecemeal. He had endeavored to make his presence tolerable to his crusty maiden aunt by assisting her to the best of his ability, and the business of the little cottage bakery had grown in consequence. An aged horse with a hanging head had been purchased for £8 at a sale, a creaking cart with a whitey brown tilt obtained for a few pounds more, and in this turnout it became Jude's business thrice a week to carry loaves of bread to the villagers and solitary cotters immediately round Marygreen. The singularity aforesaid lay, after all, less in the conveyance itself than in Jude's manner of conducting it along its route. Its interior was the scene of most of Jude's education by private study. As soon as the horse had learnt the road and the houses at which he was to pause a while, the boy, seated in front, would slip the reins over his arm, ingeniously fix open, by means of a strap attached to the tilt, the volume he was reading, spread the dictionary on his knees, and plunge into the simpler passages from Caesar, Virgil, or Horace, as the case might be, in his purblind stumbling way, and with an expenditure of labor that would have made a tender-hearted pedagogue shed tears, yet somehow getting at the meaning of what he read, and divining rather than beholding the spirit of the original, which often to his mind was something else than that which he was taught to look for. The only copies he had been able to lay hands on were old Dolphin editions, because they were superseded, and therefore cheap. But, bad for idle schoolboys, it did so happen that they were passably good for him. The hampered and lonely itinerant conscientiously covered up the marginal readings, and used them merely on points of construction, as he would have used a comrade or tutor who should have happened to be passing by. And though Jude may have had little chance of becoming a scholar by these rough and ready means, he was in the way of getting into the groove he wished to follow. While he was busied with these ancient pages, which had already been thumbed by hands possibly in the grave, digging out the thoughts of these minds so remote yet so near, the bony old horse pursued his rounds, and Jude would be aroused from the woes of Dido by the stoppage of his cart and the voice of some old woman crying, "To today, baker, and I return this stale one." He was frequently met in the lanes by pedestrians and others without his seeing them, and by degrees the people of the neighborhood began to talk about his method of combining work and play, such they considered his reading to be, which, though probably convenient enough to himself, was not altogether a safe proceeding for other travelers along the same roads. There were murmurs. Then a private resident of an adjoining place informed the local policeman that the baker's boy should not be allowed to read while driving, and insisted that it was the constable's duty to catch him in the act, and take him to the police court at Alfredston, and get him fined for dangerous practices on the highway. The policeman thereupon lay in wait for Jude, and one day accosted him and cautioned him. As Jude had to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to heat the oven, and mix and set in the bread that he distributed later in the day, he was obliged to go to bed at night immediately after laying the sponge, so that if he could not read his classics on the highways he could hardly study at all. The only thing to be done was, therefore, to keep a sharp eye ahead and around him as well as he could in the circumstances, and slip away his books as soon as anybody loomed in the distance, the policeman in particular. To do that official justice, he did not put himself much in the way of Jude's bread cart, considering that in such a lonely district the chief danger was to Jude himself, and often on seeing the white tilt over the hedges he would move in another direction. On a day when Folly was getting quite advanced, being now about 16, and had been stumbling through the Carmen Seculaire, on his way home, he found himself to be passing over the high edge of the plateau by the brown house. The light had changed, and it was the sense of this which had caused him to look up. The sun was going down, and the full moon was rising simultaneously behind the woods in the opposite quarter. His mind had become so impregnated with the poem that, in a moment of the same impulsive emotion which years before had caused him to kneel on the ladder, he stopped the horse, alighted, and glancing round to see that nobody was in sight, knelt down on the roadside bank with open book. He turned first to the shiny goddess, who seemed to look so softly and critically at his doings, then to the disappearing luminary on the other hand, as he began. "Phoebe Silverm Potens Diana." The horse stood still till he had finished the hymn, which Jude repeated under the sway of a polytheistic fancy that he would never have thought of humoring in broad daylight. Reaching home, he mused over his curious superstition, innate or acquired, in doing this, and the strange forgetfulness which had led to such a lapse from common sense and custom in one who wished, next to being a scholar, to be a Christian divine. It had all come of reading heathen works exclusively. The more he thought of it, the more convinced he was of his inconsistency. He began to wonder whether he could be reading quite the right books for his object in life. Certainly there seemed little harmony between this pagan literature and the medieval colleges at Christminster, that ecclesiastical romance and stone. Ultimately he decided that in his sheer love of reading he had taken up the wrong emotion for a Christian young man. He had dabbled in Clark's Homer, but had never yet worked much at the New Testament in the Greek, though he possessed a copy, obtained by post from a second-hand bookseller. He abandoned the now familiar Ionic for a new dialect, and for a long time onward limited his reading almost entirely to the Gospels and Epistles in Griesbach's text. Moreover, on going into Alfredston one day, he was introduced to patristic literature by finding at the bookseller's some volumes of the Fathers which had been left behind by an insolvent clergyman of the neighborhood. As another outcome of this change of groove, he visited on Sundays all the churches within a walk, and deciphered the Latin inscriptions on 15th-century brasses and tombs. On one of these pilgrimages he met with a hunchbacked old woman of great intelligence, who read everything she could lay her hands on, and she told him more yet of the romantic charms of the city of light and lore. Thither he resolved as firmly as ever to go. But how live in that city? At present he had no income at all. He had no trade or calling of any dignity or stability whatever on which he could subsist while carrying out an intellectual labor which might spread over many years. What was most required by citizens? Food, clothing, and shelter. An income from any work in preparing the first would be too meager, for making the second he felt a distaste, the preparation of the third requisite he inclined to. They built in a city, therefore he would learn to build. He thought of his unknown uncle, his cousin Susanna's father, an ecclesiastical worker in metal, and somehow medieval art in any material was a trade for which he had rather a fancy. He could not go far wrong in following his uncle's footsteps, and engaging himself a while with the carcasses that contained the scholar souls. As a preliminary, he obtained some small blocks of freestone, metal not being available, and suspending his studies a while, occupied his spare half hours in copying the heads and capitals in his parish church. There was a stonemason of a humble kind in Alfredston, and as soon as he had found a substitute for himself in his aunt's little business, he offered his services to this man for a trifling wage. Here Jude had the opportunity of learning at least the rudiments of freestone working. Some time later he went to a church builder in the same place, and under the architect's direction became handy at restoring the dilapidated masonries of several village churches roundabout. Not forgetting that he was only following up this handicraft as a prop to lean on while he prepared those greater engines which he flattered himself would be better fitted for him, he yet was interested in his pursuit on its own account. He now had lodgings during the week in the little town, whence he returned to Marygreen village every Saturday evening. And thus he reached and passed his 19th year, fi. At this memorable date of his life he was, one Saturday, returning from Alfredston to Marygreen about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It was fine, warm, and soft summer weather, and he walked with his tools at his back, his little chisels clinking faintly against the larger ones in his basket. It being the end of the week, he had left work early, and had come out of the town by a roundabout route which he did not usually frequent, having promised to call at a flour mill near Crescombe to execute a commission for his aunt. He was in an enthusiastic mood. He seemed to see his way to living comfortably in Christminster in the course of a year or two, and knocking at the doors of one of those strongholds of learning of which he had dreamed so much. He might, of course, have gone there now, in some capacity or other, but he preferred to enter the city with a little more assurance as to means than he could be said to feel at present. A warm self-content suffused him when he considered what he had already done. Now and then as he went along he turned to face the peeps of country on either side of him. But he hardly saw them, the act was an automatic repetition of what he had been accustomed to do when less occupied, and the one matter which really engaged him was the mental estimate of his progress thus far. I have acquired quite an average student's power to read the common ancient classics, Latin in particular. This was true, Jude possessing a facility in that language which enabled him with great ease to himself to beguile his lonely walks by imaginary conversations therein. I have read 2 books of the Iliad, besides being pretty familiar with passages such as the speech of Phoenix in the 9th book, the fight of Hector and Ajax in the 14th, the appearance of Achilles unarmed in his heavenly armor in the 18th, and the funeral games in the 23rd. I have also done some Hesiod, a little scrap of Thucydides, and a lot of the Greek Testament. I wish there was only one dialect all the same. I have done some mathematics, including the 1st, 6th and the 11th and 12th books of Euclid, and algebra as far as simple equations. I know something of the fathers, and something of Roman and English history. These things are only a beginning. But I shall not make much farther advance here, from the difficulty of getting books. Hence I must next concentrate all my energies on settling in Christminster. Once there I shall so advance, with the assistance I shall there get, that my present knowledge will appear to me but as childish ignorance. I must save money, and I will, and one of those colleges shall open its doors to me shall welcome whom now it would spurn, if I wait 20 years for the welcome. I'll be DD before I have done. And then he continued to dream, and thought he might become even a bishop by leading a pure, energetic, wise, Christian life. And what an example he would set. If his income were £5,000 a year, he would give away £4,500 in one form and another, and live sumptuously, for him, on the remainder. Well, on second thoughts, a bishop was absurd. He would draw the line at an archdeacon. Perhaps a man could be as good and as learned and as useful in the capacity of archdeacon as in that of bishop. Yet he thought of the bishop again. Meanwhile I will read, as soon as I am settled in Christminster, the books I have not been able to get hold of here, Livy, Tacitus, Herodotus, Aeschylus, Sophocles, Aristophanes. Ha, ha, ha. Hoity-toity. The sounds were expressed in light voices on the other side of the hedge, but he did not notice them. His thoughts went on. Euripides, Plato, Aristotle, Lucretius, Epictetus, Seneca, Antoninus. Then I must master other things, the fathers thoroughly, beat an ecclesiastical history generally, a smattering of Hebrew I only know the letters as yet. Hoity-toity. But I can work hard. I have staying power in abundance, thank God. And it is that which tells. Yes, Christminster shall be my alma mater, and I'll be her beloved son, in whom she shall be well pleased. In his deep concentration on these transactions of the future, Jude's walk had slackened, and he was now standing quite still, looking at the ground as though the future were thrown thereon by a magic lantern. On a sudden something smacked him sharply in the ear, and he became aware that a soft cold substance had been flung at him, and had fallen at his feet. A glance told him what it was: a piece of flesh, the characteristic part of a barrow pig, which the countrymen used for greasing their boots, as it was useless for any other purpose. Pigs were rather plentiful hereabout, being bred and fattened in large numbers in certain parts of North Wessex. On the other side of the hedge was a stream, whence, as he now for the first time realized, had come the slight sounds of voices and laughter that had mingled with his dreams. He mounted the bank and looked over the fence. On the further side of the stream stood a small homestead, having a garden and pigsties attached. In front of it, beside the brook, three young women were kneeling, with buckets and platters beside them containing heaps of pigs' chitterlings, which they were washing in the running water. One or two pairs of eyes slyly glanced up, and perceiving that his attention had at last been attracted, and that he was watching them, they braced themselves for inspection by putting their mouths demurely into shape and recommencing their rinsing operations with assiduity.
"Thank you," said Jude severely.
"I didn't throw it, I tell you," asserted one girl to her neighbor, as if unconscious of the young man's presence.
"Nor I," the second answered.
"Oh, Annie, how can you?" said the third.
"If I had thrown anything at all, it shouldn't have been that.
Pooh! I don't care for him." And they laughed and continued their work, without looking up, still ostentatiously accusing each other. Jude grew sarcastic as he wiped his face, and caught their remarks.
"You didn't do it, oh no," he said to the upstream one of the three. She whom he addressed was a fine dark-eyed girl, not exactly handsome, but capable of passing as such at a little distance, despite some coarseness of skin and fiber. She had a round and prominent bosom, full lips, perfect teeth, and the rich complexion of a Cochin hen's egg. She was a complete and substantial female animal, no more, no less, and Jude was almost certain that to her was attributable the enterprise of attracting his attention from dreams of the humaner letters to what was simmering in the minds around him.
"That you'll never be told," said she deedily. "Whoever did it was wasteful of other people's property."
"Oh, that's nothing.
But you want to speak to me, I suppose?"
"Oh yes, if you like to."
"Shall I clamber across, or will you come to the plank above here?" Perhaps she foresaw an opportunity, for somehow or other the eyes of the brown girl rested in his own when he had said the words, and there was a momentary flash of intelligence, a dumb announcement of affinity and posse between herself and him, which, so far as Jude Folly was concerned, had no sort of premeditation in it. She saw that he had singled her out from the three, as a woman is singled out in such cases, for no reason purpose of further acquaintance, but in commonplace obedience to conjunctive orders from headquarters, unconsciously received by unfortunate men when the last intention of their lives is to be occupied with the feminine. Springing to her feet, she said, "Bring back what is lying there." Jude was now aware that no message on any matter connected with her father's business had prompted her signal to him. He set down his basket of tools, picked up the scrap of offal, beat a pathway for himself with his stick, and got over the hedge. They walked in parallel lines, one on each bank of the stream, towards the small plank bridge. As the girl drew nearer to it, she gave, without Jude perceiving it, an adroit little suck to the interior of each of her cheeks in succession, by which curious and original maneuver she brought as by magic upon its smooth and rotund surface a perfect dimple, which she was able to retain there as long as she continued to smile. This production of dimples at will was a not unknown operation, which many attempted, but only a few succeeded in accomplishing. They met in the middle of the plank, and Jude, tossing back her missile, seemed to expect her to explain why she had audaciously stopped him by this novel artillery instead of by hailing him. But she, slyly looking in another direction, swayed herself backwards and forwards on her hand as it clutched the rail of the bridge, till, moved by amatory curiosity, she turned her eyes critically upon him.
"You don't think I would shy things at you?"
"Oh no.
We are doing this for my father, who naturally doesn't want anything thrown away. He makes that into Dublin." She nodded towards the fragment on the grass.
"What made either of the others throw it, I wonder?" Jude asked, politely accepting her assertion, though he had very large doubts as to its truth.
"Impudence. Don't tell folk it was I, mind."
"How can I? I don't know your name."
"Ah, no. Shall I tell it to you?"
"Do."
"Arabella Don. I'm living here. I must have known it if I had often come this way.
but I mostly go straight along the high road. My father is a pig breeder, and these girls are helping me wash the innards for black puddings and such like. They talked a little more and a little more, as they stood regarding each other and leaning against the handrail of the bridge. The unvoiced call of woman to man, which was uttered very distinctly by Arabella's personality, held Jew to the spot against his intention, almost against his will, and in a way new to his experience. It is scarcely an exaggeration to say that till this moment Jude had never looked at a woman to consider her as such, but it vaguely regarded the sex as beings outside his life and purposes. He gazed from her eyes to her mouth, thence to her bosom, and to her full round naked arms, wet, mottled with the chill of the water, and firm as marble. "What a nice-looking girl you are," he murmured, though the words had not been necessary to express his sense of her magnetism. "Ah, you should see me Sundays," she said piquantly. "I don't suppose I could," he answered. "That's for you to think on. There's nobody after me just now, though there may be in a week or two." She had spoken this without a smile, and the dimples disappeared. Jude felt himself drifting strangely, but could not help it. "Will you let me?" "I don't mind." By this time she had managed to get back one dimple by turning her face aside for a moment and repeating the odd little sucking operation before mentioned, Jude being still unconscious of more than a general impression of her appearance. "Next Sunday?" he hazarded. "Tomorrow, that is?" "Yes." "Shall I call?" "Yes." She brightened with a little glow of triumph, swept him almost tenderly with her eyes in turning, and retracing her steps down the brookside grass rejoined her companions. Jude Foley shouldered his tool basket and resumed his lonely way, filled with an ardor at which he mentally stood at gaze. He had just inhaled a single breath from a new atmosphere, which had evidently been hanging round him everywhere he went, for he knew not how long, but had somehow been divided from his actual breathing as by a sheet of glass. The intentions as to reading, working, and learning, which he had so precisely formulated only a few minutes earlier, were suffering a curious collapse into a corner, he knew not how. "Well, it's only a bit of fun," he said to himself, faintly conscious that to common sense there was something lacking, and still more obviously something redundant in the nature of this girl who had drawn him to her, which made it necessary that he should assert mere sportiveness on his part as his reason in seeking her, something in her quite antipathetic to that side of him which had been occupied with literary study and the magnificent Christminster dream. It had been no Vestal who chose that missile for opening her attack on him. He saw this with his intellectual eye, just for a short fleeting while, as by the light of a falling lamp one might momentarily see an inscription on a wall before being enshrouded in darkness. And then this passing discriminative power was withdrawn, and Jude was lost to all conditions of things in the advent of a fresh and wild pleasure, that of having found a new channel for emotional interest hitherto unsuspected, though it had lain close beside him. He was to meet this enkindling one of the other sex on the following Sunday. Meanwhile the girl had joined her companions, and she silently resumed her flicking and sousing of the chitterlings in the pellucid stream. "Catch ton, my dear?" laconically asked the girl called Annie. "I don't know. I wish I had thrown something else than that," regretfully murmured Arabella. "Lord! He's nobody, though you med think so. He used to drive old Drusilla Folly's bread cart out at Mary Green, till he prenticed himself at Alfredston. Since then he's been very stuck up, and always reading. He wants to be a scholar, they say." "Oh, I don't care what he is, or anything about him. Don't you think it, my child?" "Oh, don't ye. You needn't try to deceive us. What did you stay talking to him for, if you didn't want un? Whether you do or whether you don't, he's as simple as a child. I could see it as you courted on the bridge, when he looked at ye as if he had never seen a woman before in his born days. Well, he's to be had by any woman who can get him to care for her a bit, if she likes to set herself to catch him the right way." 7. The next day Jude Foley was pausing in his bedroom with the sloping ceiling, looking at the books on the table, and then at the black mark on the plaster above them, made by the smoke of his lamp in past months. It was Sunday afternoon, 4:20 after his meeting with Arabella Don. During the whole bygone week he had been resolving to set this afternoon apart for a special purpose, the re-reading of his Greek Testament, his new one, with better type than his old copy, following Griesbach's text as amended by numerous correctors, and with very arm readings in the margin. He was proud of the book, having obtained it by boldly writing to its London publisher, a thing he had never done before. He had anticipated much pleasure in this afternoon's reading, under the quiet roof of his great aunt's house as formerly, where he now slept only two nights a week. But a new thing, a great hitch, had happened yesterday in the gliding and noiseless current of his life, and he felt as a snake must feel who has sloughed off its winter skin,
and cannot understand the brightness and sensitiveness of its new one. He would not go out to meet her, after all. He sat down, opened the book, and with his elbows firmly planted on the table, and his hands to his temples, began at the beginning. He came Diathic. Had he promised to call for her? Surely he had. She would wait indoors, poor girl, and waste all her afternoon on account of him. There was a something in her, too, which was very winning, apart from promises. He ought not to break faith with her. Even though he had only Sundays and weekday evenings for reading, he could afford one afternoon, seeing that other young men afforded so many. After today he would never probably see her again. Indeed, it would be impossible, considering what his plans were. In short, as if materially, a compelling arm of extraordinary muscular power seized hold of him, something which had nothing in common with the spirits and influences that had moved him hitherto. This seemed to care little for his reason and his will, nothing for his so-called elevated intentions, and moved him along, as a violent schoolmaster a schoolboy he is seized by the collar, in a direction which tended towards the embrace of a woman for whom he had no respect, and whose life had nothing in common with his own except locality. He came Diathic was no more heated, and the predestinate Jude sprang up and across the room. Foreseeing such an event, he had already arrayed himself in his best clothes. In 3 minutes he was out of the house and descending by the path across the wide vacant hollow of corn ground which lay between the village and the isolated house of Arabella in the dip beyond the upland. As he walked he looked at his watch. He could be back in 2 hours, easily, and a good long time would still remain to him for reading after tea. Passing the few unhealthy fir trees and cottage where the path joined the highway, he hastened along, and struck away to the left, descending the steep side of the country to the west of the brown house. Here at the base of the chalk formation he neared the brook that oozed from it, and followed the stream till he reached her dwelling. A smell of piggeries came from the back, and the grunting of the originators of that smell. He entered the garden, and knocked at the door with the knob of his stick. Somebody had seen him through the window, for a male voice on the inside said, "Arabella. Here's your young man come courting. Mizzle, my girl." Jude winced at the words. Courting in such a businesslike aspect as it evidently wore to the speaker was the last thing he was thinking of. He was going to walk with her, perhaps kiss her, but courting was too coolly purposeful to be anything but repugnant to his ideas. The door was opened and he entered, just as Arabella came downstairs in radiant walking attire. "Take a chair, Mr. What's your name?" said her father, an energetic, black-whiskered man, in the same businesslike tones Jude had heard from outside. "I'd rather go out at once, wouldn't you?" she whispered to Jude. "Yes," said he. "We'll walk up to the brown house and back, we can do it in half an hour." Arabella looked so handsome amid her untidy surroundings that he felt glad he had come, and all the misgivings vanished that had hitherto haunted him. First they clambered to the top of the great down, during which ascent he had occasionally to take her hand to assist her. Then they bore off to the left along the crest into the ridgeway, which they followed till it intersected the highroad at the brown house aforesaid, the spot of his former fervid desires to behold Christminster. But he forgot them now. He talked the commonest local twaddle to Arabella with greater zest than he would have felt in discussing all the philosophies with all the dons in the recently adored university, and passed the spot where he had knelt to Diana and Phoebus without remembering that there were any such people in the mythology, or that the sun was anything else than a useful lamp for illuminating Arabella's face. An indescribable lightness of heel served to lift him along, and Jude, the incipient scholar, prospective D.D., professor, bishop, or what not, felt himself honored and glorified by the condescension of this handsome country wench in agreeing to take a walk with him in her Sunday frock and ribbons. They reached the brown house barn, the point at which he had planned to turn back. While looking over the vast northern landscape from this spot, they were struck by the rising of a dense volume of smoke from the neighborhood of the little town which lay beneath them at a distance of a couple of miles. "It is a fire," said Arabella. "Let's run and see it do. It is not far." The tenderness which had grown up in Jude's bosom left him no will to thwart her inclination now, which pleased him in affording him excuse for a longer time with her. They started off down the hill almost at a trot, but on gaining level ground at the bottom, and walking a mile, they found that the spot of the fire was much further off than it had seemed. Having begun their journey, however, they pushed on, but it was not till 5 o'clock that they found themselves on the scene, the distance being altogether about half a dozen miles from Marygreen, and 3 from Arabella's. The conflagration had been got under by the time they reached it, and after a short inspection of the melancholy ruins they retraced their steps, their course lying through the town of Alfredston. Arabella said she would like some tea, and they entered an inn of an inferior class, and gave their order. As it was not for beer, they had a long time to wait.
The maidservant recognized Jude, and whispered her surprise to her mistress in the background, that he, the student who kept himself up so particular, should have suddenly descended so low as to keep company with Arabella. The latter guessed what was being said, and laughed as she met the serious and tender gaze of her lover, the low and triumphant laugh of a careless woman who sees she is winning her game. They sat and looked round the room, and at the picture of Samson and Delilah which hung on the wall, and at the circular beer stains on the table, and at the spittoons underfoot filled with sawdust. The whole aspect of the scene had that depressing effect on Jude which few places can produce, like a taproom on a Sunday evening when the setting sun is slanting in, and no liquor is going, and the unfortunate wayfarer finds himself with no other haven of rest. It began to grow dusk. They could not wait longer, really, for the tea, they said. Yet what else can we do? Asked Jude. It is a 3-mile walk for you. I suppose we can have some beer, said Arabella. Beer, oh yes. I had forgotten that. Somehow it seems odd to come to a public house for beer on a Sunday evening. But we didn't. No, we didn't. Jude by this time wished he was out of such an uncongenial atmosphere, but he ordered the beer, which was promptly brought. Arabella tasted it. Ugh, she said. Jude tasted. What's the matter with it? He asked. I don't understand beer very much now, it is true. I like it well enough, but it is bad to read on, and I find coffee better. But this seems all right. Adulterated, I can't touch it. She mentioned 3 or 4 ingredients that she detected in the liquor beyond malt and hops, much to Jude's surprise. How much you know? He said good-humoredly. Nevertheless, she returned to the beer and drank her share, and they went on their way. It was now nearly dark, and as soon as they had withdrawn from the lights of the town they walked closer together, till they touched each other. She wondered why he did not put his arm round her waist, but he did not, he merely said what to himself seemed a quite bold enough thing, take my arm. She took it, thoroughly, up to the shoulder. He felt the warmth of her body against his, and putting his stick under his other arm held with his right hand her right as it rested in its place. Now we are well together, dear, aren't we? He observed. Yes, said she, adding to herself, rather mild. How fast I have become. He was thinking. Thus they walked till they reached the foot of the upland, where they could see the white highway ascending before them in the gloom. From this point the only way of getting to Arabella's was by going up the incline, and dipping again into her valley on the right. Before they had climbed far they were nearly run into by 2 men who had been walking on the grass unseen. These lovers, you find them out of doors in all seasons and weathers, lovers and homeless dogs only, said one of the men as they vanished down the hill. Arabella tittered lightly. Are we lovers? Asked Jude. You know best. But you can tell me? For answer she inclined her head upon his shoulder. Jude took the hint, and encircling her waist with his arm, pulled her to him and kissed her. They walked now no longer arm in arm but, as she had desired, clasped together. After all, what did it matter since it was dark, said Jude to himself. When they were halfway up the long hill they paused as by arrangement, and he kissed her again. They reached the top, and he kissed her once more. You can keep your arm there, if you would like to, she said gently. He did so, thinking how trusting she was. Thus they slowly went towards her home. He had left his cottage at 3:30, intending to be sitting down again to the New Testament by 5:30. It was 9 o'clock when, with another embrace, he stood to deliver her up at her father's door. She asked him to come in, if only for a minute, as it would seem so odd otherwise, and as if she had been out alone in the dark. He gave way, and followed her in. Immediately that the door was open he found, in addition to her parents, several neighbors sitting round. They all spoke in a congratulatory manner, and took him seriously as Arabella's intended partner. They did not belong to his set or circle, and he felt out of place and embarrassed. He had not meant this, a mere afternoon of pleasant walking with Arabella, that was all he had meant. He did not stay longer than to speak to her stepmother, a simple, quiet woman without features or character, and bidding them all good night plunged with a sense of relief into the track over the down. But that sense was only temporary. Arabella soon reasserted her sway in his soul. He walked as if he felt himself to be another man from the Jude of yesterday. What were his books to him? What were his intentions, hitherto adhered to so strictly, as to not wasting a single minute of time day by day? Wasting. It depended on your point of view to define that. He was just living for the first time, not wasting life. It was better to love a woman than to be a graduate, or a parson, or a pope. When he got back to the house his aunt had gone to bed,
and a general consciousness of his neglect seemed written on the face of all things confronting him. He went upstairs without a light, and the dim interior of his room accosted him with sad inquiry. There lay his book open, just as he had left it, and the capital letters on the title page regarded him with fixed reproach in the gray starlight, like the unclosed eyes of a dead man. He came diathic. Jude had to leave early next morning for his usual week of absence at lodgings, and it was with a sense of futility that he threw into his basket upon his tools and other necessaries the unread book he had brought with him. He kept his impassioned doings a secret almost from himself. Arabella, on the contrary, made them public among all her friends and acquaintances. Retracing by the light of dawn the road he had followed a few hours earlier under cover of darkness, with his sweetheart by his side, he reached the bottom of the hill, where he walked slowly, and stood still. He was on the spot where he had given her the first kiss. As the sun had only just risen, it was possible that nobody had passed there since. Jude looked on the ground and sighed. He looked closely, and could just discern in the damp dust the imprints of their feet as they had stood locked in each other's arms. She was not there now, and the embroidery of imagination upon the stuff of nature so depicted her past presence that a void was in his heart which nothing could fill. A pollard willow stood close to the place, and that willow was different from all other willows in the world. Utter annihilation of the 6 days which must elapse before he could see her again as he had promised would have been his intensest wish if he had had only the week to live. An hour and a half later, Arabella came along the same way with her two companions of the Saturday. She passed unheedingly the scene of the kiss, and the willow that marked it, though chattering freely on the subject to the other two. And what did he tell thee next? Then he said, and she related almost word for word some of his tenderest speeches. If Jude had been behind the fence he would have felt not a little surprised at learning how very few of his sayings and doings on the previous evening were private. "You've got him to care for 'ee a bit, nation, if you had," murmured Annie judicially. "It's well to be you." In a few moments Arabella replied in a curiously low, hungry tone of latent sensuousness, "I've got him to care for me, yes. But I want him to more than care for me, I want him to have me to marry me. I must have him. I can't do without him. He's the sort of man I long for. I shall go mad if I can't give myself to him altogether. I felt I should when I first saw him. As he is a romancing, straightforward, honest chap, he's to be had, and as a husband, if you set about catching him in the right way." Arabella remained thinking a while. "What meant be the right way?" she asked. "Oh, you don't know, you don't," said Sarah, the third girl. "On my word I don't. No further, that is, than by plain courting, and taking care he don't go too far." The third girl looked at the second. "She don't know." "'Tis clear she don't," said Annie. "And having lived in a town, too, as one may say. Well, we can teach ye so mat then, as well as you us." "Yes. And how do you mean a sure way to gain a man? Take me for an innocent, and have done why it." "As a husband." "As a husband. A countryman that's honorable and serious-minded such as he, God forbid that I should say a soldier, or sailor, or commercial gent from the towns, or any of them that be slippery with poor women. I do no friend that harm." "Well, such as he, of course." Arabella's companions looked at each other, and turning up their eyes in drollery began smirking. Then one went up close to Arabella, and, although nobody was near, imparted some information in a low tone, the other observing curiously the effect upon Arabella.
"Ah," said the last name slowly. "I own I didn't think of that way, but suppose he isn't honorable? A woman had better not have tried it.
Nothing venture nothing have. Besides, you make sure that he's honorable before you begin. You'd be safe enough with yours. I wish I had the chance. Lots of girls do it, or do you think they'd get married at all?" Arabella pursued her way in silent thought. "I'll try it," she whispered, but not to them. 8. 1 week since Jude was as usual walking out to his aunt's at Mary Green from his lodging in Alfredston, a walk which now had large attractions for him quite other than his desire to see his aged and morose relative. He diverged to the right before ascending the hill with the single purpose of gaining, on his way, a glimpse of Arabella that should not come into the reckoning of regular appointments. Before quite reaching the homestead his alert eye perceived the top of her head moving quickly hither and thither over the garden hedge. Entering the gate he found that three young unfattened pigs had escaped from their sty by leaping clean over the top, and that she was endeavoring unassisted to drive them in through the door which she had set open. The lines of her countenance changed from the rigidity of business to the softness of love when she saw Jude, and she bent her eyes languishingly upon him. The animals took advantage of the pause by doubling and bolting out of the way. "They were only put in this morning," she cried,
stimulated to pursue in spite of her lover's presence. They were drove from Spadelholt Farm only yesterday, where father bought him at a stiff price enough. They are wanting to get home again, the stupid toads. Will you shut the garden gate, dear, and help me to get him in? There are no men folk at home, only mother, and they'll be lost if we don't mind. He set himself to assist, and dodged this way and that over the potato rows and the cabbages. Every now and then they ran together, when he caught her for a moment and kissed her. The first pig was got back promptly, the second with some difficulty, the third a long-legged creature, was more obstinate and agile. He plunged through a hole in the garden hedge, and into the lane. "He'll be lost if I don't follow on," said she. "Come along with me." She rushed in full pursuit out of the garden, Jude alongside her, barely contriving to keep the fugitive in sight. Occasionally they would shout to some boy to stop the animal, but he always wriggled past and ran on as before. "Let me take your hand, darling," said Jude. "You are getting out of breath." She gave him her now hot hand with apparent willingness, and they trotted along together. "This comes of driving him home," she remarked. "They always know the way back if you do that. They ought to have been carted over." By this time the pig had reached an unfastened gate admitting to the open down, across which he sped with all the agility his little legs afforded. As soon as the pursuers had entered and ascended to the top of the high ground, it became apparent that they would have to run all the way to the farmer's if they wished to get at him. From this summit he could be seen as a minute speck, following an unerring line towards his old home. "It is no good," cried Arabella. "He'll be there long before we get there. It don't matter now, we know he's not lost or stolen on the way. They'll see it is ours, and send un back. Oh dear, how hot I be." Without relinquishing her hold of Jude's hand, she swerved aside and flung herself down on the sod under a stunted thorn, precipitately pulling Jude onto his knees at the same time. "Oh, I ask pardon, I nearly threw you down, didn't I? But I am so tired." She lay supine, and straight as an arrow, on the sloping sod of this hilltop, gazing up into the blue miles of sky, and still retaining her warm hold of Jude's hand. He reclined on his elbow near her. "We've run all this way for nothing," she went on, her form heaving and falling in quick pants, her face flushed, her full red lips parted, and a fine dew of perspiration on her skin. "Well, why don't you speak, dearie? I'm blown too. It was all uphill." They were in absolute solitude, the most apparent of all solitudes, that of empty surrounding space. Nobody could be nearer than a mile to them without their seeing him. They were, in fact, on one of the summits of the county, and the distant landscape around Christminster could be discerned from where they lay. But Jude did not think of that then. "Oh, I can see such a pretty thing up this tree," said Arabella. "A sort of a caterpillar, of the most loveliest green and yellow you ever came across." "Where?" said Jude, sitting up. "You can't see him there, you must come here," said she. He bent nearer and put his head in front of hers. "No, I can't see it," he said. "Why, on the limb there where it branches off close to the moving leaf there." She gently pulled him down beside her. "I don't see it," he repeated, the back of his head against her cheek. "But I can, perhaps, standing up." He stood accordingly, placing himself in the direct line of her gaze. "How stupid you are," she said crossly, turning away her face. "I don't care to see it, dear, why should I?" he replied, looking down upon her. "Get up, Abby." "Why?" "I want you to let me kiss you. I've been waiting to ever so long." She rolled round her face, remained a moment looking deedily aslant at him, then with a slight curl of the lip sprang to her feet, and exclaiming abruptly, "I must mizzle," walked off quickly homeward. Jude followed and rejoined her. "Just one," he coaxed. "Shan't," she said. He, surprised, "What's the matter?" She kept her two lips resentfully together, and Jude followed her like a pet lamb till she slackened her pace and walked beside him, talking calmly on indifferent subjects, and always checking him if he tried to take her hand or clasp her waist. Thus they descended to the precincts of her father's homestead, and Arabella went in, nodding goodbye to him with a supercilious, affronted air. "I expect I took too much liberty with her, somehow," Jude said to himself, as he withdrew with a sigh and went on to Marygreen. On Sunday morning the interior of Arabella's home was, as usual, the scene of a grand weekly cooking, the preparation of a special Sunday dinner. Her father was shaving before a little glass hung on the mullion of the window, and her mother and Arabella herself were shelling beans hard by. A neighbor passed on her way home from morning service at the nearest church, and seeing Don engaged at the window with the razor, nodded and came in. She at once spoke playfully to Arabella, eyes ed running with unhee hee.
I hope 'tis coming to something?
Arabella merely threw a look of consciousness into her face without raising her eyes.
He's for Christminster, I hear, as soon as he can get there.
Have you heard that lately, quite lately? Asked Arabella with a jealous, tigerish indrawing of breath.
Oh no. But it has been known a long time that it is his plan. He's only waiting here for an opening.
Ah well, he must walk about with somebody, I suppose. Young men don't mean much nowadays. 'Tis a sip here and a sip there with 'em. 'Twas different in my time.
When the gossip had departed, Arabella said suddenly to her mother, I want you and father to go and inquire how the Edlands be, this evening after tea. Or no, there's evening service at Fensworth, you can walk to that.
Oh? What's up tonight, then?
Nothing. Only I want the house to myself. He's shy, and I can't get him to come in when you're here. I shall let him slip through my fingers if I don't mind, much as I care for him.
If it is fine, we might as well go, since you wish.
In the afternoon, Arabella met and walked with Jude, who had now for weeks ceased to look into a book of Greek, Latin, or any other tongue. They wandered up the slopes till they reached the green track along the ridge, which they followed to the circular British earth bank adjoining, Jude thinking of the great age of the trackway, and of the drovers who had frequented it, probably before the Romans knew the country. Up from the level lands below them floated the chime of church bells. Presently they were reduced to one note, which quickened, and stopped.
Now we'll go back, said Arabella, who had attended to the sounds.
Jude assented. So long as he was near her, he minded little where he was. When they arrived at her house, he said lingeringly, I won't come in.
Why are you in such a hurry to go in tonight? It is not near dark.
Wait a moment, said she. She tried the handle of the door and found it locked.
Ah, they are gone to church, she added. And searching behind the scraper, she found the key and unlocked the door.
Now, you'll come in a moment?
She asked lightly. We shall be all alone.
Certainly, said Jude with alacrity, the case being unexpectedly altered.
Indoors they went. Did he want any tea?
No, it was too late, he would rather sit and talk to her. She took off her jacket and hat, and they sat down naturally enough close together.
Don't touch me, please, she said softly. I am part eggshell. Or perhaps I had better put it in a safe place.
She began unfastening the collar of her gown.
What is it? Said her lover.
An egg, a cochin's egg. I am hatching a very rare sort. I carry it about everywhere with me, and it will get hatched in less than 3 weeks.
Where do you carry it?
Just here. She put her hand into her bosom and drew out the egg, which was wrapped in wool, outside it being a piece of pig's bladder, in case of accidents. Having exhibited it to him, she put it back. Now mind you don't come near me. I don't want to get it broke, and have to begin another.
Why do you do such a strange thing?
It's an old custom. I suppose it is natural for a woman to want to bring live things into the world.
It is very awkward for me just now, he said, laughing.
It serves you right. There, that's all you can have of me.
She had turned round her chair, and, reaching over the back of it, presented her cheek to him gingerly.
That's very shabby of you.
You should have catched me a minute ago when I had put the egg down.
There, she said defiantly, I am without it now. She had quickly withdrawn the egg a second time, but before he could quite reach her she had put it back as quickly, laughing with the excitement of her strategy. Then there was a little struggle, Jude making a plunge for it and capturing it triumphantly. Her face flushed, and becoming suddenly conscious he flushed also. They looked at each other, panting, till he rose and said, one kiss, now I can do it without damage to property, and I'll go.
But she had jumped up too. You must find me first, she cried.
Her lover followed her as she withdrew. It was now dark inside the room, and the window being small he could not discover for a long time what had become of her, till a laugh revealed her to have rushed up the stairs, whither Jude rushed at her heels.
9.
It was some 2 months later in the year, and the pair had met constantly during the interval. Arabella seemed dissatisfied, she was always imagining, and waiting, and wondering. One day she met the itinerant Vilbert. She, like all the cottagers thereabout, knew the quack well, and she began telling him of her experiences. Arabella had been gloomy, but before he left her she had grown brighter. That evening she kept an appointment with Jude, who seemed sad.
I am going away, he said to her. I think I ought to go. I think it will be better both for you and for me. I wish some things had never begun. I was much to blame, I know. But it is never too late to mend.
Arabella began to cry. How do you know it is not too late? She said.
That's all very well to say. I haven't told you yet.
And she looked into his face with streaming eyes.
What?
he asked, turning pale.
Not?
Yes.
And what shall I do if you desert me?
Oh, Arabella, how can you say that, my dear? You know I wouldn't desert you.
Well then. I have next to no wages as yet, you know, or perhaps I should have thought of this before. But, of course, if that's the case, we must marry. What other thing do you think I could dream of doing?
I thought, dearie, perhaps you would go away all the more for that, and leave me to face it alone.
You knew better. Of course I never dreamt 6 months ago, or even three, of marrying. It is a complete smashing up of my plans, I mean my plans before I knew you, my dear.
But what are they, after all?
Dreams about books, and degrees, and impossible fellowships, and all that.
Certainly we'll marry, we must.
That night he went out alone, and walked in the dark self-communing. He knew well, too well, in the secret center of his brain, that Arabella was not worth a great deal as a specimen of womankind. Yet, such being the custom of the rural districts among honorable young men who had drifted so far into intimacy with a woman as he unfortunately had done, he was ready to abide by what he had said, and take the consequences. For his own soothing he kept up a factitious belief in her. His idea of her was the thing of most consequence, not Arabella herself, he sometimes said laconically. The banns were put in and published the very next Sunday. The people of the parish all said what a simple fool young Folly was. All his reading had only come to this, that he would have to sell his books to buy saucepans. Those who guessed the probable state of affairs, Arabella's parents being among them, declared that it was the sort of conduct they would have expected of such an honest young man as Jude in reparation of the wrong he had done his innocent sweetheart. The parson who married them seemed to think it satisfactory too. And so, standing before the aforesaid officiator, the two swore that at every other time of their lives till death took them, they would assuredly believe, feel, and desire precisely as they had believed, felt, and desired during the few preceding weeks. What was as remarkable as the undertaking itself was the fact that nobody seemed at all surprised at what they swore. Folly's aunt being a baker, she made him a bride cake, saying bitterly that it was the last thing she could do for him, poor silly fellow, and that it would have been far better if, instead of his living to trouble her, he had gone underground years before with his father and mother. Of this cake Arabella took some slices, wrapped them up in white notepaper, and sent them to her companions in the pork dressing business, Annie and Sarah, labeling each packet in remembrance of good advice. The prospects of the newly married couple were certainly not very brilliant even to the most sanguine mind. He, a stonemason's apprentice, 19 years of age, was working for half wages till he should be out of his time. His wife was absolutely useless in a town lodging, where he at first had considered it would be necessary for them to live. But the urgent need of adding to income in ever so little a degree caused him to take a lonely roadside cottage between the brown house and Marygreen, that he might have the profits of a vegetable garden, and utilize her past experiences by letting her keep a pig. But it was not the sort of life he had bargained for, and it was a long way to walk to and from Alfredston every day. Arabella, however, felt that all these makeshifts were temporary. She had gained a husband, that was the thing, a husband with a lot of earning power in him for buying her frocks and hats when he should begin to get frightened a bit, and stick to his trade, and throw aside those stupid books for practical undertakings. So to the cottage he took her on the evening of the marriage, giving up his old room at his aunt's where so much of the hard labor at Greek and Latin had been carried on. A little chill overspread him at her first unrobing. A long tail of hair, which Arabella wore twisted up in an enormous knob at the back of her head, was deliberately unfastened, stroked out, and hung upon the looking-glass which he had bought her. "What, it wasn't your own?" he said, with a sudden distaste for her. "Oh no, it never is nowadays with a better class." "Nonsense. Perhaps not in towns. But in the country it is supposed to be different. Besides, you've enough of your own, surely?" "Yes, enough as country notions go. But in town the men expect more, and when I was barmaid at Old Brigham." "Barmaid at Old Brigham?"
"Well, not exactly barmaid. I used to draw the drink at a public house there just for a little time, that was all. Some people put me up to getting this, and I bought it just for a fancy. The more you have the better in Old Brigham, which is a finer town than all your Christminsters. Every lady of position wears false hair, the barber's assistant told me so." Jude thought with a feeling of sickness that though this might be true to some extent, for all that he knew, many unsophisticated girls would and did go to towns and remain there for years without losing their simplicity of life and embellishments. Others, alas, had an instinct towards artificiality in their very blood, and became adepts in counterfeiting at the first glimpse of it. However, perhaps there was no great sin in a woman adding to her hair, and he resolved to think no more of it.
A new maid wife can usually manage to excite interest for a few weeks, even though the prospects of the household ways and means are cloudy. There is a certain piquancy about her situation, and her manner to her acquaintance at the sense of it, which carries off the gloom of facts, and renders even the humblest bride independent a while of the real. Mrs. Jude Folly was walking in the streets of Alfredston one market day with this quality in her carriage when she met Annie, her former friend, whom she had not seen since the wedding. As usual, they laughed before talking. The world seemed funny to them without saying it. "So it turned out a good plan, you see," remarked the girl to the wife. "I knew it would with such as him. He's a dear good fellow, and you ought to be proud of un."
"I am," said Mrs. Folly quietly.
"And when do you expect?"
"SSH.
Not at all."
"What?"
"I was mistaken."
"Oh, Arabella, Arabella, you be a deep one. Mistaken. Well, that's clever. It's a real stroke of genius. It is a thing I never thought of. Why, all my experience, I never thought beyond bringing about the real thing, not that one could sham it."
"Don't you be too quick to cry sham. 'Twasn't sham. I didn't know. My word, won't he be in a taking. He'll give it to you Saturday nights. Whatever it was, he'll say it was a trick, a double one, by the Lord. I loan to the first, but not to the second. Pooh, he won't care. He'll be glad I was wrong in what I said. He'll shake down, bless ye, men always do. What can him do otherwise? Married is married." Nevertheless, it was with a little uneasiness that Arabella approached the time when in the natural course of things she would have to reveal that the alarm she had raised had been without foundation. The occasion was one evening at bedtime, and they were in their chamber in the lonely cottage by the wayside to which Jude walked home from his work every day. He had worked hard the whole 12 hours, and had retired to rest before his wife. When she came into the room he was between sleeping and waking, and was barely conscious of her undressing before the little looking-glass as he lay. One action of hers, however, brought him to full cognition. Her face being reflected towards him as she sat, he could perceive that she was amusing herself by artificially producing in each cheek the dimple before alluded to, a curious accomplishment of which she was mistress, effecting it by a momentary suction. It seemed to him for the first time that the dimples were far oftener absent from her face during his intercourse with her nowadays than they had been in the earlier weeks of their acquaintance.
"Don't do that, Arabella," he said suddenly. "There is no harm in it, but I don't like to see you."
She turned and laughed. "Lord, I didn't know you were awake," she said. "How countrified you are.
That's nothing.
Where did you learn it?"
"Nowhere that I know of. They used to stay without any trouble when I was at the public house, but now they won't. My face was fatter then."
"I don't care about dimples. I don't think they improve a woman, particularly a married woman, and a full-sized figure like you.
Most men think otherwise."
"I don't care what most men think, if they do.
How do you know?"
"I used to be told so when I was serving in the taproom."
"Ah, that public house experience accounts for your knowing about the adulteration of the ale when we went and had some that Sunday evening. I thought when I married you that you had always lived in your father's house.
You ought to have known better than that, and seen I was a little more finished than I could have been by staying where I was born. There was not much to do at home, and I was eating my head off, so I went away for 3 months.
You'll soon have plenty to do now, dear, won't you?"
"How do you mean?"
"Why, of course, little things to make."
"Oh. When will it be? Can't you tell me exactly, instead of in such general terms as you have used?"
"Tell you?"
"Yes, the date."
"There's nothing to tell. I made a mistake."
"What?"
"It was a mistake."
He sat bolt upright in bed and looked at her.
"How can that be?
Women fancy wrong things sometimes."
"But
why, of course, so unprepared as I was, without a stick of furniture, and hardly a shilling, I shouldn't have hurried on our affair, and brought you to a half-furnished hut before I was ready, if it had not been for the news you gave me, which made it necessary to save you, ready or no.
Good God!
Don't take on, dear. What's done can't be undone.
I have no more to say."
He gave the answer simply, and lay down, and there was silence between them. When Jude awoke the next morning he seemed to see the world with a different eye. As to the point in question, he was compelled to accept her word. In the circumstances he could not have acted otherwise while ordinary notions prevailed. But how came they to prevail? There seemed to him, vaguely and dimly, something wrong in a social ritual which made necessary a cancelling of well-formed schemes involving years of thought and labor, of foregoing a man's one opportunity of showing himself superior to the lower animals, and of contributing as units of work to the general progress of his generation,
because of a momentary surprise by a new and transitory instinct which had nothing in it of the nature of vice, and could be only at the most called weakness. He was inclined to inquire what he had done, or she lost, for that matter, that he deserved to be caught in a gin which would cripple him, if not her also, for the rest of a lifetime? There was perhaps something fortunate in the fact that the immediate reason of his marriage had proved to be non-existent. But the marriage remained. 0x. The time arrived for killing the pig which Jude and his wife had fattened in their sty during the autumn months, and the butchering was timed to take place as soon as it was light in the morning, so that Jude might get to Alfredston without losing more than a quarter of a day. The night had seemed strangely silent. Jude looked out of the window long before dawn, and perceived that the ground was covered with snow rather deep for the season, it seemed, a few flakes still falling. "I'm afraid the pig killer won't be able to come," he said to Arabella. "Oh, he'll come. You must get up and make the water hot, if you want Chalo to scald him. Though I like singeing best." "I'll get up," said Jude. "I like the way of my own county." He went downstairs, lit the fire under the copper, and began feeding it with beanstalks, all the time without a candle, the blaze flinging a cheerful shine into the room, though for him the sense of cheerfulness was lessened by thoughts on the reason of that blaze to heat water to scald the bristles from the body of an animal that has yet lived, and whose voice could be continually heard from a corner of the garden. At 6:30, the time of appointment with the butcher, the water boiled, and Jude's wife came downstairs. "Is Chalo come?" she asked. "No." They waited, and it grew lighter, with the dreary light of a snowy dawn. She went out, gazed along the road, and returning said, "He's not coming. Drunk last night, I expect. The snow is not enough to hinder him, surely. Then we must put it off. It is only the water boiled for nothing. The snow may be deep in the valley." "Can't be put off. There's no more victuals for the pig. He ate the last mixing of barley meal yesterday morning."
"Yesterday morning? What has he lived on since?"
"Nothing."
"What, he has been starving?"
"Yes. We always do it the last day or two, to save bother with the innards."
"What ignorance, not to know that.
That accounts for his crying so. Poor creature."
"Well, you must do the sticking, there's no help for it. I'll show you how. Or I'll do it myself, I think I could. Though as it is such a big pig, I had rather Chalo had done it. However, his basket of knives and things have been already sent on here, and we can use them."
"Of course you shan't do it," said Jude. "I'll do it, since it must be done." He went out to the sty, shoveled away the snow for the space of a couple of yards or more, and placed the stool in front, with the knives and ropes at hand. A robin peered down at the preparations from the nearest tree, and, not liking the sinister look of the scene, flew away, though hungry. By this time Arabella had joined her husband, and Jude, rope in hand, got into the sty, and noosed the affrighted animal, who, beginning with a squeak of surprise, rose to repeated cries of rage. Arabella opened the sty door, and together they hoisted the victim onto the stool, legs upward, and while Jude held him, Arabella bound him down, looping the cord over his legs to keep him from struggling. The animal's note changed its quality. It was not now rage, but the cry of despair, long drawn, slow and hopeless. "Upon my soul, I would sooner have gone without the pig than have had this to do," said Jude. "A creature I have fed with my own hands."
"Don't be such a tender-hearted fool. There's the sticking knife, the one with the point. Now whatever you do, don't stick him too deep."
"I'll stick him effectually, so as to make short work of it. That's the chief thing."
"You must not," she cried. "The meat must be well bled, and to do that he must die slow. We shall lose a shilling a score if the meat is red and bloody. Just touch the vein, that's all. I was brought up to it, and I know. Every good butcher keeps on bleeding long. He ought to be 8 or 10 minutes dying, at least."
"He shall not be half a minute if I can help it, however the meat may look," said Jude determinedly. Scraping the bristles from the pig's upturned throat, as he had seen the butchers do, he slit the fat, then plunged in the knife with all his might.
"Ah, damn it all," she cried, "that ever I should say it. You've overstuck un. And I telling you all the time.
Do be quiet, Arabella, and have a little pity on the creature. Hold up the pail to catch the blood, and don't talk." However unworkmanlike the deed, it had been mercifully done. The blood flowed out in a torrent instead of in the trickling stream she had desired. The dying animal's cry assumed its third and final tone, the shriek of agony, his glazing eyes riveting themselves on Arabella with the eloquently keen reproach of a creature recognizing at last the treachery of those who had seemed his only friends.
"Make un stop that," said Arabella.
Such a noise will bring somebody or other up here, and I don't want people to know we are doing it ourselves. Picking up the knife from the ground where Aunt Jude had flung it, she slipped it into the gash, and slit the windpipe. The pig was instantly silent, his dying breath coming through the hole.
"That's better," she said. "It is a hateful business," said he. "Pigs must be killed." The animal heaved in a final convulsion, and, despite the rope, kicked out with all his last strength. A tablespoonful of black clot came forth, the trickling of red blood having ceased for some seconds.
"That's it, now he'll go," said she. Artful creatures, they always keep back a drop like that as long as they can. The last plunge had come so unexpectedly as to make Jude stagger, and in recovering himself he kicked over the vessel in which the blood had been caught.
"There," she cried, thoroughly in a passion. "Now I can't make any blackbot. There's a waste, all through you."
Jude put the pail upright, but only about a third of the whole steaming liquid was left in it, the main part being splashed over the snow, and forming a dismal, sordid, ugly spectacle to those who saw it as other than an ordinary obtaining of meat. The lips and nostrils of the animal turned livid, then white, and the muscles of his limbs relaxed.
"Thank God," Jude said. "He's dead. What's God got to do with such a messy job as a pig?"